Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. The fire season came early to Wyoming this year. Usually Wyoming doesn't see its biggest fires until late July, but already there have been 10 fires that have burned over 265,000 acres of land. Wet weather and the efforts of thousands of firefighters have contained the larger blazes. So what happens after a fire? Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
When the firefighters leave, the BEAR team gets to work.
BAER stands for Burned Area Emergency Response.
That's Forest Service spokesman Larry Sandoval, who used to participate on BEAER teams as a soil scientist. A BEAER team consists of a group of scientists that could include a hydrologist, archaeologist, botanist, rangeland management specialist, and a wildlife biologist. They work together to figure out how much havoc a fire wreaked. The team looks at whether people or property are in danger from mudslides, erosion, or flash floods. They also look to see if archaeological sites are exposed, if the soil is sterilized by the heat, or if invasive species threaten to take over the cleared landscape.
And then to be able to take immediate actions as warranted to manage unacceptable risks to those resources.
At the Squirrel Creek Fire west of Laramie, the smell of burn is still fresh, but the BEAER team has already completed its analysis of the charred landscape. They're required to finish within 7 days of a fire's containment. All around the land is black, the inky remnants of vegetation at times creeping up to the road and lucky untouched houses. BEAER trees stick out like toothpicks on the ridge to the north. Sandoval gets down on his knees with a shovel to show what the soil scientists look for.
So you really, first of all, get down below kind of that initial duff and organic layer, getting into the mineral soil.
He picks up a clump of soil, squeezes some water droplets onto the dirt, and watches the water get absorbed. He's checking to see if the heat has made the soil water repellent.
If you get a really severe burn area where that true water repellency, that hydrophobicity has been created by the burn, it'll just stay beaded up just like water on a waxed car.
Sandoval then scoops some soil near the bony remains of a bush from a patch of ground covered in white ash where the fire burned hotter and longer. The droplets sit on the surface this time. This is important because if water is not absorbed by soil on a large scale, it can't support vegetation and can cause floods.
The soil scientists and the hydrologists go across the landscape and kind of test that theory in terms of whether or not it burned hot enough and severe enough to cause a problem.
And the botanist and rangeland specialist will look at the potential for the spread of invasive species of plants.
Through that process, they would be assessing, okay, what's the potential for spread with those species? What sorts of treatments can we use to implement out here to mitigate that spread?
Sometimes the recommendation is as simple as monitoring the area. However, if a fire burned hotter or more severely, the BEAER team can prescribe more proactive responses.
Those are situations where the BEAER team would get in and assess, okay, are there opportunities here to do some things with the soil, break up that water repellent layer, add some organic amendments to kind of rebuild the soil, put some seed in there to get things on their way to being reestablished. And so that's part of the process as well.
At the Squirrel Creek Fire, the BEAER team found that burn wasn't so bad, and the only thing foresters have to worry about is invasive species. They recommended spraying herbicides and planting some native species to outcompete the undesirable plants. But already, not 2 weeks after containment, little green blades of grass poke through the black ground left by the Squirrel Creek Fire.
So is this kind of a best-case scenario for recovery?
I would say so. I think what I've seen and what I've heard is that, not only this, but some of the other fires we've had, things look pretty favorable as far as fires go.
Still, there's the rest of the fire season to worry about and what the BEAER team might find when they're called to inspect future blazes. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Healthcare experts gathered in Jackson this week to spell out what the Supreme Court ruling about the Affordable Care Act could mean for patients in Wyoming. Rebecca Huntington has more.
About 100 people attended the talk, sponsored by St. John's Medical Center.
I think a lot of people still don't know what's in the law itself, what's available to them, and what the ramifications might be of the law being approved by the Supreme Court and therefore being the law of the land. And how they might take advantage of it.
That's Gary Trauner, the chief operating officer for St. John's. He told the crowd that one benefit of the new law is that it requires insurance companies to make preventive services free.
So you can go in and you can get a colonoscopy or a mammogram or other preventive services with no copayment for free. Your insurance company has to pay for that. That's a significant difference from the past. So there are some benefits in the law. There are some things that people can take advantage of that they may not be aware of.
Also speaking was Kathy Swartz, a professor of health policy and economics at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's the author of Reinsuring Health, Why More Middle-Class People Are Uninsured, and What Government Can Do. She also has researched how to implement the Affordable Care Act.
So I think one big misconception is that this is going to cost all of us a lot more money. And in fact, there are a lot of savings that are called for in the law. We're already paying for a lot of care provided to people who don't have health insurance. And this is going to shift that around, and there are savings that are projected to come out of this on the order of somewhere between $124 billion to $400 billion decline in the deficit by 2020.
Swartz says that the healthcare law will not only save the federal government money, but also offers incentives to make the delivery of healthcare cheaper. For example, the law offers money to states to upgrade medical records, making them electronic, which she says would be more efficient. But so far, she says, Wyoming hasn't taken advantage of those kinds of incentives. Wyoming could also receive federal funding to set up a consumer assistance program to help citizens understand the new law. One in four people in Teton County lack health insurance. And Swartz says the healthcare law gives those people a choice.
So they have a choice of whether or not they want to obtain coverage or pay a penalty, which is relatively modest.
She adds that there are exemptions for lower-income individuals. There are still several unknowns about the new law, though. First, we don't know exactly what kinds of private insurance individuals or small businesses will be able to buy. That's up to each state to decide. Wyoming still needs to decide whether it will set up its own private health care exchange or remain on the sidelines and let the federal government do it for them. She says that if Wyoming takes the reins, it could join with other states to create an exchange that gives consumers more options. And St. John's new CEO, Lou Hoheiser, says there are other uncertainties, some of which keep him up at night.
What we haven't done is tackle the issue of how we get rid of unnecessary services. So there's a lot of money in healthcare that there are MRIs and CT scans and prostate cancer treatments that cost five times as much as the other prostate cancer treatment that don't make things any better, that we haven't said we're going to make sure we take those costs out of the system so we can pay for the expansion.
Hoheiser says the hospital will continue to keep the community informed as officials figure out the rest of the nuts and bolts surrounding the new law. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington.
When we come back, we'll look at a controversy regarding the Casper Aquifer, and we'll hear about new research regarding how coalbed natural gas production affects water quality in streams. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces on Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Casper Aquifer provides fresh groundwater to Laramie and a portion of Albany County. The water's in great condition, and the city and county have traditionally worked in tandem to keep it that way. But their paths diverged a few years ago. Now, Albany County's most recent Casper Aquifer Protection Plan resolution is open for public comment, and the public has had a lot to say about it. Rebecca Martinez reports.
Susie Pelican fills a bright yellow pitcher with water from the tap in her Laramie kitchen. She and her husband are members of Citizens for Clean Water, an activist group that has been circulating a petition calling for stronger restrictions to protect the recharge area over the Casper Aquifer east of town.
We want to make Laramie area residents much more aware of the importance of the Casper Aquifer to all of us. And it's really to not take our great water for granted and to know that we need to protect it.
Rain and snow melt seep through the ground in the recharge area between Laramie and Pole Mountain and flow pretty much untouched into the Casper Aquifer. That groundwater makes up 60% of the water in Laramie's taps and 100% of running water in the subdivisions east of town. Sarah Gorin is on the Albany County Planning and Zoning Commission and is a member of Citizens for Clean Water.
It's a very high-quality water source and is relatively pristine. But the aquifer is vulnerable to contamination. The geology of it is such that there's a lot of fractures and openings where contamination can enter the aquifer.
Interstate 80 cuts through the recharge area, and area residents fear contamination from vehicle spills. Because much of the land on the aquifer is privately owned, some stakeholders worry about too much development on the recharge area. In the late 1990s, residents asked a team of geologists to map the aquifer and the recharge area. A big part of the agreed-upon boundaries of the recharge area depended on the Satanka Formation, a rock layer under Laramie providing a barrier between the surface and the aquifer. The Satanka gets thinner as it moves eastward.
What was decided by the geologists who originally put together the plan was that you would need at least 75 feet of Satanka Formation, which is the formation that overlies the Casper Aquifer, to ensure that any potential pollution would not filter down to the Casper Aquifer.
So the geologists drew a western boundary of the Aquifer Protection Overlay Zone, we'll call it the APOZ, where they believed the Satanka was at least 75 feet thick. Laramie and Albany County used the geologists' data to create a Casper Aquifer Protection Plan, or CAP, describing the aquifer and its potential threats, and respective ordinances and resolutions to lay out how the land could be legally and responsibly managed. The CAP restricted certain activities in the APOZ, like building a petroleum pipeline or storing solid waste, and required setbacks from fractures where the aquifer is most vulnerable. The city and county worked in tandem, updating the CAP, city ordinance, and county resolution every 2 years until about 2006, when the western boundary became a problem.
The Casper Aquifer Protection Plan has this self-updating requirement of being looked at every 2 years, and the idea was that the line would be refined as new data came in.
That year, Laramie contracted a hydrologist whose research showed the protected area needed to be bigger and include more land to the west. But Albany County landowners questioned the credentials of Laramie's contractor, who is not a licensed geologist, and balked at the prospect of expanding the boundary. Mitch Edwards is an attorney in Laramie and represents a number of those landowners.
To some people's surprise, is actually we're in favor of protecting the aquifer because the value of our property and its potential utilization ultimately depends on clean water sources.
But Edwards says making sweeping restrictions for an area can devalue the land and impose on an owner's use of the land. Both the county and the city know that there are areas outside the western border of the APOZ where the Satanka Formation is thinner than 75 feet. The Albany County Planning and Zoning Commission suggested a 2,000-foot buffer west of the line where any proposed development project would have to prove to the board that the area had 75 feet of Satanka to protect the aquifer from contamination. But Albany County Commissioner Tim Sullivan says there's not enough science behind the suggestion of a 2,000-foot buffer.
You can't just arbitrarily and capriciously move the boundary without running into some serious legal problems. Unless we have scientific evidence and we go through hearing procedures on the moving of the boundary, you know, we'll end up in court. And as you know, Albany County doesn't have a whole lot of money. So what we want to do is make sure we spend our money judiciously and do things the correct way.
But the Citizens for Clean Water group is still pushing for the buffer. Their petition also calls for more scrutiny on all building projects within the APOZ, asking that they prove that they won't harm the aquifer. The current draft resolution requires site-specific geological studies for all proposed development, but exempts building on property that has already been zoned residential. There are also certain areas within the APOZ where the county wouldn't have to consider the thickness of the Satanka as evidence for moving the boundary. Susie Pelican says that doesn't work for the Citizens for Clean Water.
This mandated exclusion of verifiable scientific data that's relevant to the safety of the aquifer is really just unacceptable.
County Commissioner Tim Sullivan says he doesn't expect the Board of Commissioners will make many changes to the draft resolution before it passes. Still, he says he's looking forward to seeing the data the Wyoming Geological Survey is collecting about all the aquifers in the state and hopes it will lead to more satisfactory evidence of where the APOZ boundary should go. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
The Albany County Board of Commissioners will be hearing public comments about the CAP resolution until August 7th. We turn now to a different water issue. The U.S. Geological Survey recently released a study examining how coal bed natural gas production affects water quality in nearby streams and rivers. We're joined now by Melanie Clark, the author of the report. So, Melanie, tell us about this project.
Well, we've had a very intensive monitoring network up in the Powder River Structural Basin because of coal bed natural gas development up there that we've been monitoring with the Wyoming DEQ and the Bureau of Land Management. And one of the questions that comes up repeatedly is whether or not water quality is changing because of the coal bed natural gas development in that area. So we've been monitoring for 10 years, and the purpose of this particular study with the Wyoming DEQ was to help answer the question whether water quality is changing because of the coal bed natural gas.
And so what did you find? What were your key results?
Well, we have monitoring sites throughout the basin, and the findings were sort of mixed. There were some changes that are consistent with what you might expect from coal bed natural gas. The Powder River at Arvada did show increasing sodium, which is not desirable, but most of the sites really showed no trend, which indicates that overall, over the 10-year period, that the water quality was not changing substantially. So that is good news.
Why would coal bed natural gas production affect water quality? I mean, what's going on there that actually would cause waters in nearby streams to be affected?
Well, the main concerns were in the Tongue River Basin and in the Powder River Basin, where the sodium in the coal bed waters is actually higher than the sodium that occurs in the stream waters. And bicarbonate is another constituent associated with the coal bed waters that could be increased in the stream waters. And there have been some concerns about toxicity related to bicarbonate.
So in other words, the water that is basically extracted during the natural gas production, that would then could end up mixing with stream water and causing the makeup of the stream water to be different.
That's correct. A fair amount of the coal bed natural gas water is discharged at the surface in Wyoming. And then you have the interaction of the waters with the soils that can change, you know, even further because they can pick up minerals dissolving in the subsurface through the soil profile. So, you know, the water quality may be changing because it's picking up, you know, things as it migrates through the soil profile.
And the minerals that are in question here that may be, you know, getting out of the water in the ground and into the streams, are those problematic? I mean, is this bad that they're getting into the streams in some cases?
Well, the two constituents that have come up repeatedly, the sodium bicarbonate, which is largely associated with the coal bed waters, are, you know, pretty natural constituents. There's a lot of sodium in those drainages to begin with because of how arid some of those drainages are. So they're not unusual constituents to find in stream waters. So these aren't types of constituents that have exceeded water quality standards, for example.
What additional research needs to be done on this?
Well, I think the most important work that needs to continue up there is just continued long-term monitoring of the sites. You know, we didn't have any findings that needed any sort of immediate attention, but I think it's important to continue to monitor the streams as the play continues. And, you know, it sometimes you may not know what questions are going to be asked 20 years from now. So I think just continuing monitoring up there, in particular on the main stems and the major tributaries up in those basins, is important for a long-term water quality picture as the play moves on.
All right. Well, Melanie, thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure. Thank you.
That was Melanie Clark with the U.S. Geological Survey.
When we come back, we'll check in with residents of Pavilion about how the investigation of water contamination is going, and we'll talk with a former Olympian from Israel who survived the 1972 Munich massacre. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. In December, the Environmental Protection Agency released a draft report tentatively linking water contamination in the town of Pavilion to hydraulic fracturing activities in the area. The release of the draft report caused a spectacle, and state, federal, and tribal agencies are now caught in a bureaucratic holding pattern while residents affected by contaminated water wait in a form of investigative limbo. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone attended a recent Pavilion workgroup meeting to get updates on the investigation.
It's the first Pavilion workgroup meeting to be held in months. However, as of Wednesday's latest meeting, Pavilion residents still have no idea as to what's contaminating their water. Nearly 6 years ago, residents in the farming and ranching community began complaining of health problems they blamed on water contamination. They went to the state to get help in figuring out what was going on, but the state brushed them off. Instead, Pavilionites went to the Environmental Protection Agency for help, and the EPA then entered the investigation. In December 2012, the EPA released a draft report linking hydraulic fracturing to water contamination in the area, which has become a source of heated debate. However, the EPA's Ian Schmidt says there is definitely a problem in the area.
We certainly believe that EPA's data show that there is contamination in the aquifer.
Again, the report was just a draft. But when it was released, Encana, who operates wells in the area and contributes greatly to Wyoming's economy, as well as the state, freaked out. It later came to light that Governor Matt Mead pushed the EPA to withhold their draft analysis an entire month to give the state enough time to come up with viable rebuttals to scuttle the report. Encana called the EPA's investigation unsound science, and Paul Ulrich with Encana maintains this line of argument even today.
Encana felt the data set was incomplete. In our estimation, two samples does not get you to a point where you need to be drawing conclusions. More samples, more effective samples, in our opinion, are needed before any conclusions could be drawn.
So with contaminated groundwater and numerous state, federal, and tribal agencies investigating, the Pavilion Work Group was formed, a group of government industry officials and residents tasked to review and discuss data associated with the investigation, as well as cleanup, jurisdiction, and who's paying the bills. John Fenton is the only resident on the group, but he says he's been kept out of the loop.
I find that really troubling, and that's kind of the same way we've been treated out there. No one has any authority that can do anything. You know, we're expected to look out for ourselves as landowners and catch the problems and then try to find somebody to rectify those.
Pavilion residents acknowledge it's suspicious that representatives of Encana are even permitted to be part of an independent investigation of their own company.
And you see a real inequality with that, because there's one of us from the affected community on there, myself. And Encana has, there was three or four of them sitting at the table today. I think we should have multiple community members.
At Wednesday's public work group meeting, the audience included members of the EPA, the State Oil and Gas Commission, Wyoming Department of Water Quality, Encana, U.S. Geological Survey, a tribal official, a water development officer, and an advisor for the governor. Jeremiah Riemann is Governor Mead's natural resource advisor. He says jurisdiction, for instance, over groundwater is contentious.
I think we have some unanswered questions about who has responsibility for the downhole and or surface activities on tribal land, Bureau of Rec. And this is one of those instances where we've got a lot of federal minerals that are owned by various different agencies, BLM, Bureau of Reclamation. The tribes are involved there.
The EPA hopes to collaborate with stakeholders to find a source of contamination in Pavilion and mitigate it. In past analysis of water in the area, the EPA has found elevated levels of benzene, synthetic organic chemicals, petroleum hydrocarbons, and recently naphthalene, a chemical often used in mothballs. However, INCANA wants them to look at other potential sources of contamination as well and compile a list of possible culprits.
It's got to be a good scrub list, but other potential sources out there could include old dumps, septic systems, and who knows what else.
So how can the audience judge if it's a good scrubbed list, then?
Ulrich was unable to answer the question. The EPA also wants to look at oil and gas pits that are now out of commission and that INCANA has voluntarily remediated by varying standards. The EPA's Ian Schmidt says that might be insufficient.
The overall objective is to be sure that in an area where we do see constituents in drinking water wells that cause us some concern, that we have a careful look at the degree to which any pits may be posing a current or a future risk to drinking water.
The discussions from this meeting were full of jargon and hard to follow, and that was troubling for members of the public, especially residents from Pavilion in attendance, like John Fenton.
Trying to learn geology and the science behind this and trying to keep up on all the rules and regulations is very difficult when you're running a farm or a ranch. And as you've seen, the people that are in charge of this don't even know whose authority a lot of this goes under. So a lot of this is really time-consuming and really confusing for the average person, no matter how well-studied you are on it.
This isn't the last work group, but at this point there are two major questions on people's minds. First, when new data is released from state and federal agencies, will INCANA dispute it and derail the process again? The second is that if a final conclusion is reached, who will be held responsible for contamination, and more importantly, who will pay to clean it up? Pavilion residents are eager to see who the new oil and gas commissioner will be, as that may help expedite the process and be more open to feedback from Pavilion. As you may recall, the former oil and gas commissioner, Tom Dahl, left his position in disgrace in June after announcing that the Pavilion residents affected by contaminated groundwater were primarily in search of a payout from fracking operators. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
We're joined now by former Olympian Dan Alon. He was a fencer on the Israeli team in the 1972 Munich Olympics. That year, terrorists broke into the Olympic Village and attacked the Israeli team members, killing 11 of them. Alon was one of the few who escaped. He'll be speaking in Jackson on August 9th, and he joins us now to talk about the Munich massacre.
It happened on the 5th of September in the morning at 4:30 in the morning when all the athletes were sleeping in the Olympic Village, and I was waking up by a very big sound of explosion and shouting and noise, and in the beginning I thought it might be some celebration of the South American delegation not far from us, but then it was quiet, so we went back to sleep, and 20 minutes later I heard another explosion, and this time it was the noise of machine guns. So I knew already something is wrong, and we were in the apartment, five athletes, number two apartment, and we went to the window in the front, and we saw outside by the apartment number one in the entrance is standing some guy with a white hat and a machine gun in his hand, and he's talking to a policeman, a German policeman in German, and we understand what he was saying. that they attacked the Israeli building. They killed already two athletes, and they demand from Israel to release from prison in Israel about 200 Palestinians. If not, they were going to kill all the hostages. We didn't know how many hostages there are, how many terrorists there are. And then they throw out the body of the wrestling coach to the pavement, and two paramedics took him away. And then we decided that we have to do something, or to fight back or to escape. We had some idea because we had two shooters in our apartment, Olympic shooters, and they had rifles. So one of the shooters loaded one of the rifles, and he decided maybe we can shoot the terrorist who is standing outside, and then we can run away. But then we decided it's too dangerous and it's too risky because we didn't know exactly what's going on there. And we decided the best thing that we would run away. In the front, we couldn't run away, so we had to run away from the back, from the garden, from the balcony. Also, there was one of the terrorists guarding the side. But we had to take a chance and to run outside each one by one. In spite, he was standing there and he will shoot, we have to take the risk. And we escaped from the building to the German police, who were already standing not far away from there.
I can only imagine how traumatic that must have been for you. How did the attack change the way you viewed Arabs?
Well, I was a soldier in the army before. I took part in the Six-Day War and in the Yom Kippur War. But I couldn't believe that they will do something like this in the Olympics. For me, the Olympics was symbolizing me peace and friendship and unity between nations. And I couldn't understand how human being can choose some place like this for a terror attack. And that really, I was very disappointed.
Did the attack change the way you viewed the Olympics? I mean, you said that you saw the Olympics as a way to unite people. Did this change how you saw the Olympics?
Yes, I think the Olympics is very politic. The moment that you have flags in the Olympics, it's become politics. And the team, all kind of team actions, that like football, like basketball, it's not a good place for the Olympics. You have to make it only individual sport, to people to come there only by a name, by the name, and by the ability of his, and to give all the best what he can, and not to shout and not to applaud the state where he comes from, the athletes and the name of the athletes. That's what I think they have to do in the future.
You have often spoken about what happened, about the attacks. What is the main message that you would like people to take away? What can people learn from what happened here?
Well, first of all, I started to talk about it 6 years ago, and I gave a lot of lectures in America already about Munich. I became like a messenger suddenly. And also I decided to write a book. And 2 months ago it was published the first time. The name of the book is Munich Memoir. And in this book, it's really describing everything, even many things that are not yet published. And there I give all my message for everybody, that you have not to forget what's happened. It's become a piece of history, like the Holocaust. You have never to forget it. So the same with Munich Massacre. And In the book, it's really written all about it, what happened before Munich, what happened in Munich, and what happened after Munich, my life, my feelings, and my opinion, political opinion, and everything.
All right. Well, Dan, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you also for you, and see you in Wyoming.
That was Dan Alon, one of the members of the Israeli Olympic team in 1972. He'll be speaking about the Munich massacre in Jackson on August 7th.
Back, we'll look at the state's new rules regarding unpasteurized milk, and we'll talk with the creators of a new musical that takes place in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Wyoming Department of Agriculture recently proposed new food safety rules. One of the most contentious adjustments has to do with raw milk. That's milk that's not pasteurized. It's already illegal to sell raw milk in the state, but if passed, the new rules would make it illegal to obtain it unless you own your own dairy cow. This has some milk drinkers very upset. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff reports.
Frank Wallace hosts a herd of 12 milk cows on his ranch in Recluse, Wyoming. He drives through the pastures full of pines and sagebrush to look for them. When he finds them, they're standing amidst small hills striped rust and cannery yellow.
So here's a few more of the cows. So we've got, what, three brown Swiss cows here. Another Jersey cow here.
Wallace doesn't own the cows, he just takes care of them. They belong communally to about 70 families who have bought into cow shares to obtain unpasteurized, unprocessed, raw milk from them.
The people that want to own a milk cow but can't, for some reason or don't have the time, they buy into the cow share. In my case, it costs them $50. That's the property. They get a bill of sale. It's like buying a motorcycle.
Then each shareholder pays $35 a month for Wallace to care for the cows, to milk them, and cover any veterinary bills. Each family gets about a gallon of raw milk a week out of this arrangement. It's a bit more complicated and expensive than going to the local grocery store for a gallon of milk, but that's because sale of raw milk is illegal in Wyoming. According to Dean Finkenbinder, manager of Consumer Health Services with the Wyoming Department of Agriculture, the cow shares are also illegal, but not much is done about it.
It's been probably a while ago we sent out letters to people that we knew or that we had seen were advertising animal shares and told them that it was illegal.
It hasn't been enforced much beyond the letters, of which Wallace has a small file, but a newly proposed food safety rule would potentially change that. The rule is being updated to align with the 2009 Food and Drug Administration Food Code, and according to the Department of Agriculture, would make it so producers, who are the sole owners of animals, can serve raw milk in their home to family members, non-paying guests, and employees of the farm or ranch. The word sole is what has Wallace's cow share owners worried. For some, like Nicholas Delatte, a cow share owner, the concern stems from an almost religious dedication to raw milk and its health benefits.
Health is definitely the reason for my children. I want the healthiest that I can provide for them, and I believe that buying a cow share, knowing the cow that I'm buying it from, knowing the producer of that cow, is probably the best way that I can control the health and liability of my children.
Amongst raw milk drinkers, like Delatte, there's the belief that unprocessed milk is more nutritious, full of more good bacteria and fat, and tastier.
After we put my kids on raw milk about a year ago, we ran out of milk and I bought whole milk out of the store. And I give some to my daughter, my four-year-old, and she looks at it and she gets this really weird look on her face and she goes, "Dad, this tastes like water." The taste is different and you can tell that the nutrients are probably going out with that taste.
Wallace's ranch also touts a healthy diet for the cows. He does not use antibiotics or hormones on the animals, and he runs a small business, which helps local economies. Wallace works with cow share owners who attribute previously sick children's recoveries to raw milk, and cancer patients gaining their weight back who say raw milk is responsible. FDA spokesperson Curtis Allen says these claims are scientifically unfounded.
As a scientific-based organization, FDA has to follow the science. While the nutritional health benefits have not been scientifically substantiated, the health risks are clear. Not only that, the science shows no meaningful difference in nutrition content.
And the whole reason why raw milk is not easily accessible is because it is associated with disease. Wyoming had 3 outbreaks resulting in 18 illnesses from 2003 to 2008 that were attributed to raw milk consumption. A recent study by the Centers for Disease Control showed that the risk of developing disease from unpasteurized milk is 150 times greater than from pasteurized dairy. For CDC's researchers, those statistics outweigh any benefits. But drinking raw milk can be a political act, in addition to a health decision. Here's Frank Wallace again, who runs a cow share in Campbell County.
When I started doing this, I did it as kind of a little bit of a pushback against the state, and I'm wagging my fingers, quote unquote.
So there's the question of whether raw milk is actually good for you, but more important, says Anna Graha Norstegard, another cow share owner, is the question of who gets to decide that.
We can do all kinds of dangerous things. We can smoke all the cigarettes we want. We can drink all the alcohol we want. But we can't drink raw milk. Food is our most basic. If you control food, you control people. It's the quickest way to control someone is to control their food supply.
For Wallace, it boils down to this.
Who chooses? The government or the parent?
There will be a public hearing on August 22nd in Cheyenne regarding the proposed changes to the rules. Wallace isn't sure yet what he'll do if the word soul stays in the rules, but he doesn't think he'll stop making raw milk.
I guess we never really learned from history. Back in the 20s and 30s, they said, okay, no more alcohol in the United States. Well, that spawned a huge industry called bootleggers. So instead of moonshine, I guess I'll be a moonshiner.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
The Heart Mountain Relocation Center near Powell was one of several in the country that interned Japanese Americans during World War II. The camp now sets the scene for a new musical called Allegiance, starring George Takei of Star Trek fame. The story follows the Kimura family in the weeks after they're forced to leave their farm in Salinas, California, and move to the internment camp in Wyoming. I spoke with producer Lorenzo Tione and composer Jay Kuo, who co-wrote and produced the play, which will open in San Diego in September. Tione says the story follows a brother and sister, Sam and Kay.
They live with their single father and their grandfather. So a grandfather who had come from Japan and a first-generation immigrant father. And so both Sam and Kay are Nisei. They're born in the United States. And they live in Salinas, California, when after the drop of the bomb on Pearl Harbor, the events sort of start to be set in motion that lead to the internment of Japanese Americans, and the Kimura family ends at Heart Mountain in Wyoming.
I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling me about the inspiration for this story. I understand that George Takei was sort of instrumental in helping inspire the story.
Yes. So Jay and I were together in New York City seeing a show called In the Heights. And just a couple seats over in our same row was George and his husband. We noticed that, though, midway through the show, there's this one moment, very emotional moment, when the father in this family of immigrants is really feeling helpless and sings and cries about how he needs to find a way to help his daughter. And we noticed that George was really, really moved by that moment. And later on at intermission, we actually asked George what was that had touched him so much about that moment. And he embarked in telling us how it reminded him of his father during the years that his family and he were
were taken from their home in California and brought at Rover Camp in Arkansas. And I remember looking at Jay, and in an instant we knew we were thinking the same thing.
And I was going to ask why the play is set in the Heart Mountain Relocation Center.
Sure, I'll let Jay answer that question. Sure, well, as you may know, there were 10 internment camps in America, and so looking through each of them and trying to determine, you know, which of these would make a good setting. And I looked up the name, Heart Mountain, and it just drew me. And so I started learning more about the actual place. And it turned out that it had one of the most rich histories among all of the camps, because in Heart Mountain, there were 63 people who actually stood up to what was happening to them and refused to enlist for the draft. They said, you know, you've kept our families behind these barbed wires for years without charge, and now you're asking us to sign up and go fight for a country that denies the freedoms that it's proclaiming it's protected. It's an amazing story that happened right in Wyoming. So I thought it was not only did the name initially draw me, but after I started doing a bit of research into Heart Mountain, came across the story and thought it was just a fantastic one to sort of lay the central conflict in allegiance.
So tell me what, I mean, since it's a musical, I mean, this is something that, you know, would make a pretty heady kind of a novel that could be sort of dark. I wouldn't automatically think of this as great material for a musical. What's the tone of the songs?
Well, it's interesting. You know, some of the most successful musicals are not what people consider to be musical comedy. If you think of West Side Story, think of Les Miserables, you know, these are, and Miss Saigon, these are large epic pieces, not all of them, but, and happily. Now, Allegiance happens to be about reconciliation and redemption, a possibility for healing and the importance of family. But my philosophy of music theater is that the reason people need to sing is because their emotions and stakes are so high that they can't be represented in any way other than in musical form.
I was wondering if you, whether you or Lorenzo would talk to me about the theme of allegiance, you know, since it sort of seems to explore allegiance to a bunch of different entities. What kinds of allegiance does the play explore?
Sure. At its core, I mean, the musical asks, allegiance at what price? In other words, when Pearl Harbor happened and people's lives were turned upside down merely because they happened to look like the people who bombed Pearl Harbor, and they were rounded up summarily and sent to these camps, there was a split within the Japanese-American community that wasn't really well known. And that is that the younger American-born Nisei, the second generation, they really felt American, and they felt like they wanted to prove to the rest of America that they were just as American. And so when the opportunity to go sign up for war, but their parents, who had everything taken from them, their land, everything they had worked for whole generations, there was a lot of bitterness and resentment there. And so there arose a question within the community: how far should our allegiance go? And to whom do we owe the allegiance? And so this question split the community. It's still not resolved, because today there are people who say that what happened at Heart Mountain, for example, the draft resistance, was a blemish upon Japanese-American history. But then there's a faction that says they were doing as American a thing as you can do, which is to protest. And so that question, you know, can this happen again? Can a people, based upon a characteristic that they're either born with or born into, be treated a certain way just because something terrible has happened to America? And so I think that these questions still arise, still haunt America. And so that's one of the reasons Allegiance remains, the show remains so contemporary and so current. It's raising questions that we haven't resolved yet.
Lorenzo Tione and Jay Kuo, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening.
That that's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter.
Today, we're saying goodbye to our reporter and host, Tristan Autone. He's been with Wyoming Public Radio for about 2 years and is now moving on to New Mexico. Thanks, Tristan, for all the great work, and we wish you lots of luck in the future.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.